He's insightful, that one. No, thankfully, the person who gets tired of my voice the quickest is me. I like 25 minutes in, and I'm thinking, is he still talking? You got to be kidding me. But anyway, so we got a lot to talk about today, a lot to cover, so we're going to jump right in. So here's where we're headed today. We are going to start with our passage. We're going to start looking at, just introduce the passage, read it, get familiar with it a little bit. Then we're going to pull way back, and we're going to talk about some of the ways that the Bible communicates the point it's trying to make. Now, I'll tell you, that section right there is going to be challenging. That's going to be a little difficult. It's going to be a lot more like a work session than a sermon. But I wouldn't just do that anywhere. You know, I wouldn't do this sort of thing just anywhere. But I know that you are serious about Bible study. I know that you want to know how to study the Bible. I know that you want to get better and deeper at Bible study. And so I know that I can do that sort of thing here, and I know that you're interested in that and want to grow in that. And so we're going to take some time to do some work at that point. Then we're going to come back to our passage. We're going to apply what we talked about in that section of thinking about how the Bible gets its point across, and then we'll make some application, and then we'll be done. So let's start with this. Every Bible document, well, let's just talk about the New Testament because that's where we are at this point. Every Bible document is what's called an occasional document. Now, that doesn't mean that you should only read the Bible occasionally. That's not what that means. That means that every Bible document was written for a specific occasion, for a specific reason. The Bible documents were not written because the writer sat down and was just thinking one day and went, I haven't written to the Romans in a while, I'll write them a letter. The Bible documents were written because there was an occasion, there was a reason, there was a need of some kind, and the writer is addressing that need. Well, that's helpful for us to know because the more that we can figure out about that occasion, the better we understand what the book is saying. And so we can spend some time, and sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it takes some digging. But for instance, Galatians, here's an easy one. Galatians, what's the occasion? What's the problem? Well, the Galatian Christians were being influenced by false teaching that said you have to keep the law of Moses. And so Paul writes to address that. Or we think about 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy was written because the church at where Timothy was at Ephesus was lacking leadership and organization. And they needed to get things situated. And so Paul wrote a letter telling them how to do that. We think about Romans. Romans probably is one of the main books viewed as just written because. Oh, and in fact, Romans was written to deal with some internal strife and division. The Jews and the Gentiles didn't always know how to get along. And so Paul writes the book of Romans. 1 Peter was written because the Christians were being persecuted and suffering and struggling with that. 1 Corinthians is an easy one. They were just completely jacked up. I mean, if there was something they could have wrong, they had it wrong. And so Paul writes to address their problems and their questions. This morning, we're going to be, as we continue our series on godly living in ungodly times, this morning we're going to be in the book of Philippians. You can turn there and we'll look at that. And in fact, I think the more that you can actually read out of the Bible this morning, I think the better, the more that you'll be able to get out of it, whether it's on your phone or whatever it's on. Be sure and turn down the Angry Bird notifications, though, if you would. I'd appreciate that. Does anybody still play that? Is that still a thing or not? Is it still Angry Bird? But we'll be in Philippians, and we'll look at some other things, and I think it'd be helpful to actually be looking at what the Bible says. Why was Philippians written? I heard somebody say just this past week, I was watching a sermon, and the man said what lots of people say. He said, the book of Philippians is written to a church that had no problems except for one. He said there were two women who didn't know how to get along. He said other than that, they had no problem. He said other than that, they were joyful. The book's all about joy, and they had no problems. And that's just not true. That's not the case in Philippi. And so when we look at the book of Philippians, let's ask ourselves, what was the occasion? When Paul looked at the church at Philippi, and what did he see? And what did he see that needed to be addressed? Well, let's look at the opening part of the book, Philippians 1 and 2 is where we're going to be this morning. Philippians 1 and 2. So let's look at Philippians 1 and verse 27. Now, as we read this, I want you to ask yourself, what is he addressing here? He's not saying this just to have something to write. What is he addressing in these two verses? Philippians 1 and verse 27. Only conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or remain absent, I will hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel, in no way alarmed by your opponents. He just gave us a three-point outline. Love is hard. Well, that's great. What is going on at Philippi that Paul is addressing? What did you see that he wants them to do? What did you see that they're dealing with that is a challenge? Well, notice, first of all, what he wants from them. He says in verse 27, I want you to stand firm and strive for the faith of the gospel. I want you to be faithful and be active in living out the gospel. That's the baseline. That's what he wants. How does he want them to do it? Look again at verse 27. He says, I will hear that you are standing firm, what? In one spirit. I will hear that you are striving, what? Together. He says, what I want is for you to be diligent and active in living your faith. But there are two challenges to that. There are two challenges. Did you see what they are? Did you see what the challenges are? The first challenge is external. It's the opponents. It's those who are persecuting them and opposing them. He says, I don't want you to be alarmed by them. That indicates that they may well be. And they're not working as hard as they could. The second issue, moving us toward what we want to talk about this morning, the second issue is internal, and it's selfishness. He says to them, I want you to strive together. I want you to stand firm in one spirit, which indicates that they may not be doing that very well. And as we see the book develop, that's exactly what we find. They're having trouble getting along and working together. And he has to address that. So here's what he does. He says in chapter 2, let's talk about this selfishness issue. He says, here's what I want from you. Verse 3, here's what I want. This is 2:3. Do nothing from what? Selfishness. Well, if they weren't doing anything from selfishness, he wouldn't have to talk about it. But he says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for what? Your own personal interest, but also for the interest of others. That's what he wants. Now look what he's going to do. He's going to give them four examples. Four examples of people who lived selflessly. Who's the first example? Verse 5. Who's the first example? It's Jesus. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus. And he talks about his humility and what he did. Then he gives himself in verses 17 and 18 and says, I'm being poured out as a drink offering. I am going to die for you. Then he gives the example of Timothy and his selflessness. And then he wraps up the chapter with Epaphroditus and his selflessness. He says, what I want from you is to get along, to live out your faith together, not to be divided, not to fight, not to fail to get along. That's what I want. And then he says, here's what I want you to avoid. And here is our text for this morning. Here's what I want from you. Look at verse 14. Do all things without grumbling, or my translation says disputing. Your translation may have something like questioning or something like that. The idea seems to be arguing with each other. So look how the passage progresses. Here's what I want you to do: all things without grumbling or disputing. Now, notice verse 15. What does he say? So that. Catch that. So that. I don't want you to complain or argue, so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God, above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast or holding forth the word of life. That's what we're going to focus on. That's our text for this morning. Philippians 2, 4, really 14 and 15 is what we're going to be focused on this morning. So he says, do all things without complaining and without arguing. So I'll just take a pause here and just say, if you never complain, then you could ignore that part of the sermon. If you never argue with anybody, if you never bicker, fight, debate, quarrel, you can leave, you can quit now and go home. You forget the whole thing. But if you ever complain, or if you ever argue, I'll ask that you stick around and see what Paul has to say about that. Don't complain or argue so that, so listen to what he says. If you will do that, if you will stop complaining and stop arguing, you will prove to be blameless and innocent, children of God, above reproach. Where? To what purpose? In the midst of a crooked and perverse generation among whom you appear as lights in the world. Now let's stop right there. I want to talk to you a minute. So turn over to Matthew 18. And I want to just, so we're going to take a detour for a moment. We're going to talk about some ways, turn back to Matthew 18. We're going to talk about some ways that the Bible reasons. Some ways that the Bible structures its arguments to get its point across. Now, the Bible's not the only thing that does it. Everybody does what we're talking about. We're talking about the Bible. So we'll just keep it to what we're talking about. So here is how the Bible, here's an example of how the Bible reasons. Now, I'm going to look just for a moment. We're going to look at Matthew 18, beginning in verse 12 through verse 20. I've heard various snatches and snippets and sections of that passage taken out and used in ways that were less than optimal, and I've heard them used in ways that were downright in error. Why did that happen? Because people were taking snippets and snatches and sections instead of what? Instead of looking at it all together. So look at how he makes the argument he's making. Jesus is speaking. You knew that from the red letters. Jesus is speaking, and he says this. Look at verses 12 and 13. What does he do? In verses 12 and 13, he tells a story about a man that has sheep, and one of them goes astray. He goes and he finds it. That's the story. Now, look at verse 14. Verse 14 begins, in my translation, begins with the word so. What he's going to do in verse 14 is tell us what that story's about. So, it is not the will of your Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones perish. And it's illustrated by the story of the man and the sheep. Now, in my Bible, and notice what yours does, in my Bible, what I just looked at right there is its own section. The next part is its own section with its own heading, and then there's more after that. And that's not right. No wonder people misread it. So look at what he says. He tells a story about a man who rescues one of his sheep. Verse 14, that's God's will that nobody perish. Now, look at verse 15. If your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. Do you see why that's there? Do you see why that's there? If your brother sins, goes back to one of them has what? Gone astray. And go and show him his fault corresponds to what? The shepherd going and finding. So beginning in verse 15, he's going to tell us practically, here's what the story means to you. Let me explain the story. If your brother sins, go and try to win him back. Verse 16, if he doesn't listen, now notice, take what? Take what with you? Two or three. Talk to him. If he doesn't listen, verse 17, tell the church. If he doesn't listen, then church discipline has to be exercised. He has to be removed from fellowship, according to verse 17. Now look in verse 18, where Jesus gives them reassurance because, look, verses 15 to 17, some of the hardest stuff anybody will ever do. And you know that's true because next to nobody does it. You know it's hard because next to nobody does it. Most people don't go and talk to their brother who sinned. They go and talk to everybody else about the brother who sinned. And then if there is some movement on it, they don't follow the pattern. We're big about that in churches of Christ, aren't we, following the pattern? Do you see this passage being followed as a pattern? Not typically. But I mean the church as a whole. I'm not talking about this congregation. So he says, I've given you some hard things to do, 15 to 17. But listen, he says in verse 18, truly I say to you, whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. Is that verse just pop up out of nowhere? What is he saying? He says, if you will go through the pattern that I've given you to restore the wandering sheep, I will be with you in what you've done. Verse 19, again. What does again do in that verse? It connects it back. Again, I say to you that if two of you agree on earth about anything they may ask, it shall be done for them by my Father who is in heaven. When you follow the pattern, God backs you up. Verse 24, what does that do? Connects it to everything that he already said. For where two or three have gathered, wait a minute, where how many? Two or three. Have we just read something about two or three? What did he say? If he doesn't listen to you, take two or three with you. It's all the same thing. Verse 20 is not there to say, even if you're a tiny church, God is still with you. There's no doubt that's true. No question that's true. But that's not the point. That whole section goes together. And when you see how it goes together, you can understand it better. We need to know how the Bible argues, how it reasons. So let me give you some examples. Sorry, someone went wacky with my ear right there, and I'm having a little trouble. It didn't sound right, so my apologies if I sound weird. Some of the ways that the Bible reasons. Sometimes the Bible reasons by giving us material and then giving us a summary. It gives us material and then gives us a summary. In Hebrews 5-7, there's a long discussion about Jesus as our high priest. And then in chapter 8 and verse 1, he very helpfully says to us, the main point in what has been said is, he's summarizing it for us. Doesn't always do that, but a lot of times it does. Another way that the Bible makes its argument is the use of a pivot. So a pivot is something like this. In 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 11, Paul says, do you not know the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, adulterers of evidence. And he gives that long list. And then he says, and such were some of you. Then he says, but That was then, but what? But now you are washed, etc. It's a pivot from what it was to what it is. And you can look for words like but, or sometimes and, then, something like that. And then parenthesis, and this may be one of the most challenging, because you're reading along, you're understanding, everything's great, and then you hit a parenthesis, you're like, what in the world is he talking about? So it works like this. There's a section, there's a passage that you're reading along, and then the writer, guess who it almost always is? And guess how long it can be sometimes? A long section, which is great. Thanks, Paul. So a parenthesis, for an example, we talked about this recently, is Ephesians 3. In Ephesians 3, 1, he says, for this reason, and he's about to tell them, I'm praying for you. But here's what he says. For this reason, I, Paul, the prisoner of the for the sake of you Gentiles. Then he says, wait a minute. I just told them that I'm a prisoner because of them. That might make them feel bad. And so he goes on a lengthy section where he says, don't feel bad for me, I'm great. And then he comes back and he says, for this reason I bow my knees before the Father. But if you don't know that that's a parenthesis, you're going, what in the world is he talking about? Now, of course, what we're talking about is this, what we talk about all the time, right? What we talk about that I'm sure you're sick of hearing about. You're sick of hearing me talk about. We're talking about context. That's all we're talking about. But when we talk about the structures, we're talking about understanding why a specific conclusion comes from a specific context. And the more that we can understand about that, the better we understand the Bible. If you want to take your Bible study to another level, this is the kind of thing that does it. Understanding how the Bible speaks and gets its point across. Now, moving to our point, I promise. There's a couple of different ways the Bible does that, and they're related. One of the ways the Bible does that is top down. The Bible goes from talking about general things to specific things. But it can also go bottom up. The Bible can talk about specific things and then move toward general things. Okay? So, here's what we're talking about. Sometimes the Bible reasons from the general to the particular. We saw an example of it about 10 minutes ago when we were talking about Philippians 2. Sometimes the Bible does this in order to illustrate. Remember this? When Paul said, I don't want you to be selfish. Now let me give you some examples of what that means. That's what that is. He's arguing from the general to the particular. Sometimes the Bible does it to make application. I was going to go through that passage. I'm not going to do that to you. We'll move on. But you can make a note if you want to look at that later, you can. But sometimes the Bible reasons from the particular to the general, from specific things to general things. And that's exactly what's happening here in our passage, Philippians 2. And the purpose of it is to give us motivation. So, you survived. You made it. We're into the good part now, right? We're into the part where we're going to read it and apply it. So back to Philippians chapter 2. Back to Philippians chapter 2. Let's get this thing done. Philippians chapter 2. Do all things without grumbling. What does that mean? Complaining. Or disputing. What does that mean? Arguing. What's wrong with complaining? What's wrong with complaining? I mean, doesn't everybody do it? Doesn't everybody you know do it? Don't you do it? Don't you sometimes feel better when you do it? Doesn't complaining sort of give us an outlet so that we get it out and feel better? What's wrong with complaining? Well, I'll give you several things. First of all, it demonstrates a lack of confidence and trust in God. It says that God has allowed me to get into a situation and He doesn't know what He's doing because this is not good for me. Complaining demonstrates a loss of gratitude and contentment. You can't be grateful while you're complaining. You just can't. You can't. And the Bible says to be grateful and content. Complaining leaks negativity onto others. Complaining leaks negativity onto others. I bet if I were to say to you, do you know someone in your life who is a chronic, constant complainer, you would get somebody in your mind and you would roll your eyes and groan inwardly and say, oh, yes, and it drives me nuts. Because it does. It brings everybody down. Complaining is wrong because it leads to spiritual corrosion. When you complain, you're corrupting your own spirit and making things harder for yourself. Complaining lures us away from legitimate pursuits. As long as you're complaining, you're not fixing the problem. And finally, complaining limits the ability to solve problems. You may not know it, but every time you complain, you do damage to the part of your brain that helps you solve problems. I don't know about you, but I don't need any more brain damage than what I have already. If I can avoid some brain damage to the part of my brain that helps me solve problems, I'd like to do that. So don't complain. That causes a problem there. What do these things have in common? Israelites in the wilderness, consumed by fire from God. Israelites in the wilderness who were supposed to receive a promised land but didn't, and instead had to wander in the wilderness for 40 years, where up to 2 million of them died. A plague sent from God that left 15,000 dead. What do those things have in common? They're all God's response to what? Complaining. That's serious. God doesn't take complaining lightly. Well, what about arguing? You know anybody who likes to argue? You know anybody who isn't happy unless they've got some sort of an argument, playing devil's advocate, arguing with you about something? They told me when I was, Kaylee, you'll appreciate this, they told me when I was about 6 years old that when I grew up I should be a lawyer because I like to argue all the time. I don't know, Mac, if she's that way or not. We'll talk about that later. But what's wrong with arguing? What's wrong with being an argumentative person? Well, first of all, it's specifically forbidden. It's specifically said, God said, the Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome. It's literally in there. It made the list. It made the list. In Proverbs 6, the list of 7 things that God hates. Now you can imagine when God sat down one day and He said, I'm going to make a list of 7 things that I hate. And so He made a list and there were about 100 of them on there. They said, that's too much. I need to pare that down. That won't fit in the book of Proverbs. I'm going to keep paring that. I'm going to keep paring it down and paring it down. And He's crossing off and crossing off and crossing off until finally He gets to the 7. What do you know about those 7 things? They're really bad. And being argumentative and causing strife made the list. James tells us that it's worldly. He devotes over a chapter to it. James tells us that being argumentative is demonic. It comes from Satan. And Paul tells us that it keeps us from God's kingdom. You cannot be an argumentative, divisive person and go to heaven. You just can't. It's a big deal. And so Paul tells the Philippians and us not to do those things. Do all things without grumbling and disputing, so that you prove to be blameless and innocent and above reproach. Just going to put those together because they're very, very similar. As Christians, we want to be pure, holy, and good. How do we do that? Well, we don't cuss. We don't drink. We don't go clubbing. We don't go to movies that other people, you know, that maybe got stuff in. We don't do that stuff. All of which is great. But do you see in this passage that Paul says that if you want to be good, pure, and holy, you can't complain or be argumentative? That's part of holiness too. And then he says that if you will not complain or argue, you will be children of God. We want to be children of God, don't we? We want God to be our Father. We want His blessings and protection. We want Him to love us as our children. Well, how do we get there? Well, we think that it's by baptism, and church membership and correct doctrine, and those things are essential. But did you know that it also means not complaining or being argumentative? That's part of it too. And then he says, you want to do all this so that you can be a light in the world. I don't know about you, but I'm concerned about our world. I'm concerned about the world as a whole. I'm concerned about my country and where we're going and how we're regressing and what we're approving and promoting. I'm concerned about my community. I'm concerned about Carteret County and Morehead City and the issues that we have here, which are real and they're serious. And I don't know about you, but I would like to be a light in that. I'd like to be a light in that. I would like to shine a light in that darkness. Well, how do we do that? Well, we know the arguments. We know how to argue people out of false religious groups. We know how to argue people out of atheism. We know how to rebuke people who do things wrong. Maybe. But what he says is, if you want to impact the world, what does he say? Stop complaining and stop arguing. Isn't that amazing? So, next week, Lord willing, we're going to have this final lesson on godly living in ungodly times. We're going to look at Acts 4, where the apostles begin to suffer because of their faith, and we're going to see how to handle that. But to conclude, let me just ask you three questions. Do you have light in the world in your job description? Is it important to you to be a light in the world? When you get up in the morning, is one of the things that you want to happen, that you want to make happen, is for you to shine light in your space? Do you live morally and ethically? And do you understand that not complaining and arguing is part of that? The problem is, it's so easy to fall into because literally everybody does it. Everybody does it. And when everybody does it, it's hard to realize that you've fallen into it. I've started saying the word no funny. No. Not no funny, no funny. I started saying the word no in a funny way. That's what I mean. Now, do you know why that is? Because y'all do. No. That's the way y'all talk. No, I have to go home. Do y'all get those? It's just like, I thought I was moving to North Carolina like I'm in Scotland or something. It's the weirdest thing. You people are so weird. But I noticed that after 20 years, sometimes when somebody says something, I go, no, no, no. It's ridiculous. Here's one I never thought would happen, because the first few times I heard it, I thought, she says that. And then I've started saying it occasionally. When I'm talking to more than one person, I say, you crowd. You crowd. Who says that? You people. You crowd. I say mommy. I say it. Why do I do that? Because I'm around you people. I think it was Aubrey. Was it you, Aubrey, that told me that you were out in Virginia or somewhere in Kentucky? And a bunch of you people were talking, and the waitress came up and said, y'all from Eastern North Carolina? Right? Because he's saying, y'all want something to drink? Aubrey said, no. Well, wait a minute, I'll take a Coke before I go home. See, no. But I never said, because when I heard y'all talking like that, I was like, that sounds terrible. I'll never talk that way. And here, I just do it. Why do I do that? Why did I start saying you crowd, for heaven's sake? Why did I start saying mommy? Because I'm around people who say that stuff all the time. And I just picked it up and started doing it. And that's the way it is with complaining and arguing. Everybody complains. Good gracious. Everybody complains. Everybody complains. Weather. So hot. So hot. So cold. Now it's hot again. Can't make up its mind. Too cool. Wore a jacket. Now I'm hot. Just complain all the time about stuff. And so you do it, and you're like, you just don't notice it. Everybody else does it, right? Arguing the same way. There is, in our society today, there is a baseline level of anger that almost everybody has. Almost everybody's ticked off about something. Everybody's ticked off about something. And everybody's got a hair trigger. Everybody's like right there. And all you got is some little thing, wham, there it goes. Sorry, Carol, I didn't mean to make you jump. But that's how quick it is. So everybody does it. And so you get argumentative and grumpy and complainy and divisive and debate, and you just don't even notice that everybody else is doing it. But that's the point. Paul says, if you won't complain and argue, you'll be like a light in darkness. Just by doing those two things, if you'll stop complaining and you'll stop being argumentative, you will stand out like a bright light in utter darkness. Isn't that amazing? That's what he says. Well, our song this morning, Ray, what is our invitation? 922, number 922. Take out the songbook and be ready to sing that song, number 922, and we'll sing that as an invitation song. We've been talking to believers this morning. That's what we do. The assembly, the New Testament assembly, really is designed really for believers. Not that unbelievers are not welcome. We love people who are not Christians to come. A lot of value. We've had people who've been converted, and it's great. But when we come together, it's really a time for the church to receive edifying. So we've been talking to the church this morning. And if you realize, as we talked about these things, that there are some things that you need to improve, you need to get better about, you need to stop doing, and you need help, we're here to help you. Maybe you are not a believer. Maybe you're here and you're not a Christian. And you would like to be a light in the world, but you're not shining yet. You haven't plugged in yet. You haven't flipped the switch yet. Because you're not a believer. You're not a Christian. There's a way to go through that process, and we'd love to talk to you about it. Maybe this morning you're ready. We have water here. We have garments here. Everything's ready if you're ready to be baptized. But if you'd like to study, we want to study with you. Whatever the case. This morning, if you have a need, and we can help with it, we'd love to know. We'd love to talk to you privately after church, or you can come forward and take a seat on the front as we stand and sing.